death is our business, and business is good.
So how does it happen that Evgeny Prigozhin goes from this businessman to warlord? The Russians are just throwing these kind of meat waves at people. This is the moment where Prigozhin realizes he is being locked out.
Welcome to The Rest is Classified. I'm David McCloskey.
And I'm Gordon Carrera.
We're starting this deep dive into the world of Yevgeny Prigozhin, restaurateur to Vladimir Putin, co-founder, I think we'd say, of the infamous Wagner Group.
Yeah.
Private mercenary army.
Who, a couple of years ago, led a mutiny, effectively, which was the closest Vladimir Putin has ever come to being toppled from power. And it was due to this one guy who has started off selling hot dogs. So Evgeny Prigozhin, born in Leningrad in the Soviet Union, which is, of course, now called St. Petersburg. He's a bit of a misfit, doesn't fit in. He can see people around him leading a fancier life, but he quickly gets into crime. And it starts with petty crime. He's hanging around with low-level criminals or on the make. They swindle a man out of 250 rubles over some jeans. They go out drinking champagne to celebrate and brandy at a restaurant. And at that restaurant, about midnight, they see a young woman with a fancy coat leaving the restaurant. And this coat speaks of money. So Prigozhin says, let's rob her. And in a dark street, one of them asks her for a cigarette. Then Prigozhin grabs her by the neck and he starts to choke her. Another man pulls a knife. She screams. Prigozhin, to try and stop her, squeeze harder on her neck until she passes out. But her screams have already kind of summoned the police, who are nearby. So these gang of thieves run. One of them doesn't make it. Prigozhin does. But the police will eventually track them all down and come knocking. So now he's in big trouble. So he's going to get sentenced to 13 years in a penal colony. This is the Vorovskoy Mir, the thieves' world inside these gulags, these prison camps. Of course, there's violence, prisoners in these huge barracks, and the barracks are run by the prisoners rather than by the guards and the officials. You have to make friends with the big guys to survive. It's the same lesson you learn in any prison, as you know from your time in Texas Penitentiary, David.
That's right.
You're either in... Sorry, you weren't there, but...
You can't, if you're watching now, all of my tattoos are covered up, so...
So you were in or out of the gang, but he learns to play by the system. Prigozhin gets released in 1990. So that's effectively the last year of the Soviet Union before it's going to collapse. And Russia, as it hits the 90s, enters this wild decade. Economic collapse, massive social change, a kind of Wild West mafia capitalism. In some ways, the outside world is now becoming like the world of the Russian or the Soviet prisons.
The prisons.
It's kind of mirroring some of that power structures in which having protection is actually, translating into the business world of Russia. His side hustle, and I love this, is running kiosks in Leningrad selling hot dogs. Now, sausages have been around for a while in Russia, Soviet Union, but the key was...
No bun. No mustard.
No mustard. No ketchup. So you do that, and suddenly you take the old sausage, add those things, and you have something kind of cool and Western and new, which in the 1990s we're going to do very well.
It's the genes of the culinary world, isn't
it? Is.
The hot dog.
Yes. That's our first food reference. But he's making money pretty quickly. And he says he's having to pay $100 per kiosk per month, protection money to the gangs. So you get a sense already that, he's getting to know the gangs and understanding how to navigate that world. So he moves on from hot dogs. He manages some grocery stores and then casinos. And then comes the big break, because he opens a restaurant called the Old Customs House. It's a fancy old 19th century building on the riverfront near the Winter Palace. And it's interesting, because Prigozhin can be charming, but also violent. He supposedly assaulted a chef after a complaint from a customer about the quality of the food. The chef was taken to the cellar and pummeled to the point of being hospitalized for 2 months. It's like, not quite Gordon Ramsay shouting at you, but it's a lot worse.
It's not merely verbal abuse.
No,
yes, indeed.
It's a lot worse. So yeah. he's got a mix of charm and violence. But about that time, it's thought Putin is kind of moving in these circles. So in some ways, Putin and Prigozhin, I think, are kind of similar, because they are two people who've grown up on the wrong side of the street, mm-hmm. And Putin has come from quite a poor background in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. And he grew up in a kind of crowded apartment blocks. And Yulia Yoffe, the journalist, talks a bit about this, about the world of the courtyard, the vor, which is where, the courtyard of these apartment blocks as a boy Putin would have to show he could survive against the bullies and the thugs. And he's a small guy, Putin.
Yeah.
And so his way of surviving was to show he was capable of more violence than anyone else.
It's essentially, I mean, it's not quite this, but it's not dissimilar to the dynamics of the prison camp.
Exactly. So Putin, we should say, has been a KGB officer, but then around the time of the end of the Soviet Union, he moves into city government as an advisor to the mayor of St. Petersburg. And so it's at that point that him and Prigozhin are going to meet in this kind of murky milieu of, you know, kind of spies, crooks, officials. Prigozhin's restaurant business grows, and this is important for the story because he's inspired by a trip to Paris and he sets up his new company, Concord Catering, and Concord will be the name, which is the kind of overarching business structure, which is going to run a lot of these things. They're going to buy a rusty old boat, remodel it, and turn it into a fancy floating restaurant called New Island. Now, this does really well. Has its own truffle menu, David, which I always like.
He's gone from hot dogs to a truffle-themed menu.
With white-glove waiters. He's moving up. By 2000, you know, the end of the 90s, Putin is president of Russia. 2 months after he becomes president, Putin brings the Japanese prime minister to the New Island floating restaurant. Putin wants to show off to all these kind of foreign leaders who he's bringing to Russia. Actually, Russia isn't what you thought it was, this kind of collapsing country. You know, we're capable of having fancy restaurants. Now, the point is, he's going to use his friendships to get big government contracts. So he's now moving from restaurants to catering supply. He gets a contract for food for schools. Putin himself will open one of the factories doing the supply. I don't think the kids got the truffles and the caviar. I think this was a slightly lower level of catering. And actually, there's lots of reports in later years about the kids, you know, end up with vomiting bugs and dysentery from a daycare and
the quality control was lax relative to the state dinners he was serving.
So he's getting, particularly gets to know a guy called Dmitry Bulgakov, who's in charge of logistics for the Ministry of Defense. And that gets him a crucial contract for the military worth about £500 million, $750 million to supply food for the Russian army. Now, that is a big
contract. That's a big deal.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
That's huge.
Yeah. So, as anyone who runs a restaurant will know, PR, public relations, you know, is a big deal in the restaurant world. Prigozhin spends a lot of money, you know, resources promoting himself. He's big on early social media.
And if he were around today, he'd be posting thirst traps on Instagram. But instead, you know, he's early stages.
Early stages. Yeah. Interestingly enough, he's also big on the kind of dark arts to go after anyone who's critical. One example of the dark arts, June 15th, 2012, a round table is being held to launch a new business publication. But actually, the whole thing had been organized by Prigozhin's team, many of whom are posing as part of this new publication. But what they've done is they've ordered in catering from Prigozhin's rival for big catering contracts. And then what happens is the guests who are Prigozhin's people, who are supposedly amongst the VIPs there and working the publication, start vomiting. It's all blamed on his rival's catering for this event. And his rival loses loads of contracts. So in 2012, it looks like one of Putin's top kind of political advisors, Vyacheslav Volodin, meets Prigozhin. And this leads, crucially, to Project Lacta, run out of a squat building in St. Petersburg, home to this organization, now notorious, called the Internet Research Agency. The Kremlin sees itself as engaged in a kind of political warfare with the West. The West is trying to stir up protests in Russia and in its neighborhood, and their job is to stop that. So, you know, the idea is you control the information space to prevent the CIA through the internet, which Putin says the internet's a CIA project, undermining the grip on power. The aim is domestic stability.
Then I guess around 2014, As Russia takes Crimea, little green men going into Ukraine, you get this kind of hybrid war where the Russians have starting to kind of set their sights on destabilizing Ukraine as a political project. Those tools get turned abroad for the first time.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's the interesting moment. Starts domestic, but it starts to expand the foreign desks. There's a bit of it which is obviously into Ukraine itself, but they're also trying to press certain narratives into Western media, into European media, about what's happening in Ukraine and about attacking the idea that Russia has somehow invaded or tried to take parts of Ukraine. But then crucially, it's going to start turning its focus not just to Europe, but to the United States, because now we're into kind of 2014, but already they've got their eyes on an American election coming up in 2016. And they're immediately going to start thinking, how can we mess with the American election?
It really is, I guess, in the wake of this effort that Prigozhin becomes known.
Yeah.
Inside the U.S. And really, it kind of puts a target on his back in a
way. Yeah. One of the interesting things is then Putin starts getting asked about, Prigozhin. And he compares Prigozhin to George Soros, the Hungarian philanthropist who supports liberal causes around the world. And the point that Putin is making is like, these are just people, rich people, you know, pursuing their own private endeavors. George Soros, Yevgeny Prigozhin, you know, they've got their own agendas.
Yes.
One and the same. And Putin, I love this, Putin kind of mocks the West for falling so low as to suspect a restaurateur from Russia of influencing the US election. You know, he's like, how could you think this chef could, you know, possibly influence your election? So how does it happen that Yevgeny Prigozhin goes from this businessman to warlord? Spring of 2014, he's introduced to another key character, a 44-year-old called Dmitry Utkin. Now, Utkin is a former lieutenant colonel in the Russian Special Forces. What kind of person was Dmitry Utkin? I've got a picture of him, which I think tells you quite a lot. Shaved head, mean eyes.
Mean eyes.
Yeah. He has SS tattoos on his shoulders and neck. Supposedly a Nazi eagle on his chest. His wife would say he was never happy unless he was fighting. I mean, you know. And in Russia, if you hit 40 in the military, no sign of advancement, you're out. So he'd left because he kind of wants to fight rather than go up the ranks. So he joins a mercenary group, ends up fighting ISIS with kind of crap weapons. They're going to withdraw in failure. He's looking for what to do next. He gets introduced to Prigozhin. And I think it's a fortuitous meeting. It's a kind of romance. You know, no, it's not a romance.
Bromance?
Bromance. Utkin has got a reputation for violence. He would sometimes greet Prigozhin with Heil Petrovich, using his boss's code name, and supposedly sign some documents with SS symbols. But here's the crucial thing, again, back to his kind of Hitler obsession, though, because I think he really does have a Hitler obsession. He had become...
Utkin does.
He'd become obsessed with Wagner, the composer who was Hitler's favorite. And so his call sign as a mercenary is Wagner. So he is Wagner. Prigozhin, he's going to understand now that the Kremlin needs a little bit of help with men of violence and mercenary work. And with Utkin and with his people, there's an opportunity there. We're talking about that meeting between Utkin and Prigozhin in 2014. This has happened just as a pro-Kremlin government has been removed from power in Ukraine. Kremlin is angry. Famously, Russia kind of seizes Crimea using undercover special forces who just pop up in Crimea. These are the famous people called Little Green Men. They've got no visible affiliation to Russia, and they say they're a local self-defense force, but basically they're Russians. And before anyone knows it, before the West can react, Moscow seized Crimea and is going to annex it. But then in the east of Ukraine, there's also violence in the Donbass region, and it's going to draw in Russian nationalists and imperialists from Russia to come and fight in Ukraine. You know, they want that bit of adventure. But they're struggling against the Ukrainian military. And so mercenaries are the obvious answer, aren't they, for Russia? If you want to help these groups fight, but you don't want to invade at that point, it's 2014, not 2022. You don't want to have your own military go into a war. You don't want the West to then, you know, kind of turn against you. At this point, they don't want to do that. They don't want to also lose lots of their own troops if, you know, and have the body bags come home.
There's a business need.
Utkin is, as I said, Wagner. The group also sometimes called the orchestra, which I love. You know, and the fighters, musicians, and the battles they engage in are called concerts. I mean, this weird jargon. But it's only 200 people or so at the start when it's in Ukraine. And they're going to turn up in Luhansk, in the Donbass, where local forces are on the back foot. Crucially, they down a military transport in June 2014, which kills 49 Ukrainian servicemen. So a big deal. The mythology starts to build. Utkin, you know, will claim he was injured in the fight for Luhansk airport, where his 40 men take on 400 Ukrainians, taking them by surprise. Ukrainians actually say it was more like 150 of their men, you know, who had to retreat. But then you get the Minsk agreements, which are going to kind of freeze the conflict, which I guess in a way means it's over for Wagner. Their need seems to have passed at that moment.
Well, Gordon, though, an enterprising and psychopathic chef, of course, is going to find new markets, isn't he?
Yeah, most restaurateurs would be like, where can I open my new restaurant? We're here with our Gordon Ramsay of the of the Russian warlord going, new market, you know, Syria looks good for an opening. The civil war, I guess, has been raging. President Assad is struggling in Syria against the opposition forces, rebels and ISIS. And of course, Moscow wants to support Assad, but a bit like Western governments, it doesn't want to do the full scale intervention. It doesn't want to put, you know, boots on the ground, does it? So I guess what it's going to do is use air power to bomb the rebels and then give some support on the ground through mercenaries, you know, through Wagner and others. By 2016, you're going to have about 2,500 Wagner mercenaries stationed in Syria. Interesting enough, the salary for a mercenary then is about $4,000 to $5,000 a month. Pretty good.
It's not bad.
It's not bad. Nearly four times what a normal Russian soldier earns. So Wagner's now got some kind of, tends to be experienced commanders, you know, your Utkins and his people who are kind of running the show. And then you get all of these recruits who are coming in to kind of be the guys on the ground, doing it basically for the money. Yeah. You know, often only for 6 months or so. Sometimes they're people who are ex-soldiers themselves. But you read about them and that, you know, they're sometimes like taxi drivers, you know, or mechanics who are just like,
it's good money.
It's good money. I'll do this for 6 months, big payday, and go back home. I think one of the other things that comes of that is the reputation for brutality really starts to emerge here in Syria. And there's one particular set of videos which come out in June 2017. There's some of a man being beaten with a sledgehammer. Also of a body being set alight, there's a beheading. There are people kicking the guy's head around who's been beheaded. And these videos start to circulate amongst Russian military veterans. And this is a kind of big moment, actually, in Wagner, in its story, because it's going to cement this idea that Wagner are a kind of nasty bunch, capable of brutality, but also create a kind of cult around them amongst people who kind of like that in Russia, I think, which is a bit wild. But it's going to help recruitment. That's what's kind of crazy, particularly amongst military veterans, nationalists and others.
Who would like to be swinging a sledgehammer.
Who would like to be swinging a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
Wagner plays a role in the Palmyra operations, 2016, then the Syrian forces.
This is a fight against the Islamic State.
When Wagner wins some battles there, who gets the credit? Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu tells Putin, we took Palmyra. And then Prigozhin says, no, we did. And Shoigu reportedly stated that the Gopniks cannot go down in history. Now, Gopnik is like a low-level crip. It's a thug.
Thug.
A thug. Or also have the kind of connotation of being trashy, working class. It says something already about the way in which Wagner is seen as these kind of rough guys. The military are like, can't let them have credit. The other thing which is going to be important for Prigozhin, though, I think, is that he starts to see, doesn't he, that how do you make money? And one of the answers is in Palmyra, there's some oil and gas.
Yeah.
And he's going to work out.
Gas town.
It's a gas town. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a way of funding this.
I think he knows the rules.
Yeah.
You know, and he's got protection from, even if he's getting into, you know, fights with the defense ministry, he's doing this because, you know, Putin and the people above him in the Kremlin, they want this to happen.
Yeah. But now, Prigozhin is going to move to try and take that model global, effectively, and to kind of build it further afield into new conflicts. And Prigozhin and his private jet will be spotted all over Africa. He often travels now under a fake name and wearing disguises and wigs.
It looks like Sacha Baron Cohen and the Dictator.
It's Sacha Baron Cohen and the Dictator. That is exactly what it is. I mean, I can't believe he actually used some of these. I mean, like massive, big, fake beards.
Admittedly, especially the one here in the bottom left where he's got those big shades on.
Yeah.
You really can't tell it's him.
No. And Africa is a continent where, you know, depressingly, there are conflicts, there's violence, there are governments who need help against
providing security.
Providing security, but against, you know, militias, rebels. ISIS is on the rise in parts of Africa, the Islamic State group. So there's a kind of logic to it.
Yeah.
You know, a couple are interesting to kind of understand what Prigozhin is doing. Central African Republic, one of the kind of early places, landlocked country full of gold and diamonds. So already you can see the attraction for Mr. Prigozhin, who's learned in Syria that oil and gas, natural resources are good for business. He's saying, we can help protect your regime. We can fight off any opponents and militias. We can secure and guard the natural resources. And all you have to give us in return is a cut, little concession.
You make it sound sinister, Gordon.
One of the interesting questions is, how far is this Moscow? And how far is it, you know, Prigozhin? And the answer is, it's as ever with this story, it's quite hard to tell. The whole thing about Putin is you want to be a global power, not just like a regional power. And of course, Wagner is a kind of low-cost way of projecting power across Africa. And there is this way in which it's a kind of modern form of colonialism, you know, resource extraction in war zones, guarded by Wagner mercenaries, financed by the profits they extract. The British system, you know, the East India Company in the earliest days was a private company, which basically takes over India and has its own armies and militias and eventually gets absorbed into the state. But there's a kind of age-old aspect to this, but just kind of placed into the modern Russian context, I guess. And then I love this fact, from 2021 until mid-2022, at least 16 planes loaded with gold departed Sudan for a Russian-controlled airbase. Some of the other examples, touch on briefly, are interesting as well. Libya, big civil war since the overthrow of Gaddafi. It's one of those conflicts, the civil war, where you get lots of other countries pile in with proxies to support one group or the other. Interestingly, November 2018, Prigozhin was filmed at talks between Russia's defense minister and General Haftar. And Russian officials respond by saying there that he's there in his role as a caterer.
As a caterer.
Organizing an official dinner.
We're back to the Gordon Ramsay comparison.
Yeah, exactly.
The informal motto for Wagner, Gordon, has become, death is our business and business is good.
Wow.
Wow. Put it on the t-shirts.
Yeah.
That's right.
He is building his own brand and the brand of Wagner quite effectively. And I think Prigozhin himself, you see, start to change a bit. It's a bit like Joseph Conrad's famous novel, you know, The Heart of Darkness, in which Kurtz, you know, this kind of colonel goes into Africa and is changed by it. And I think Prigozhin himself starts to become a little bit wilder. You know, and you can see it in the pictures that we looked at. But he feels more like a kind of international outlaw. But also the problem for him, I think, is that he's also becoming famous for this because people are watching Wagner, and particularly in the West, they start freaking out. You know, 2018 onwards, he's getting sanctioned by the US as well. Heavier sanctions on him personally, mainly because of the election interference. And so he's also worried about his assets and he's trying to kind of move them around. He's getting his private jets impounded. And I think he is resentful. He's not with the, you know, with the cool kids in Moscow invited to, you know, sit at the ice hockey games. He's just that little bit too wild and dangerous to be legit. And then, you know, but I think he leans in, which is what, if you're a management consultant, you probably tell him to lean into the brand, you know, kind of, if you're going to be, if that's your brand, go for it. Prigozhin gives his first interview to the Western press, speaks to the Sunday Telegraph. Interestingly, he is still denying any connection between him and Wagner or the Internet Research Agency.
Yeah, I suppose there's no advantage to actually outright admitting it, right?
Yeah, he says, you know, I've got no connection to Wagner, I've got no connection to mercenary groups. Worries me greatly that some people think I have such a connection. I am a pacifist, he says.
It's like pacifist. We're now, I guess, Gordon, in early 2022, February of 2022. The Russians are amassing nearly 200,000 troops on the border with Ukraine.
That's right. So the Russian military have got their plan to topple President Zelensky in Ukraine. And
it's a good plan.
It's a good plan.
It's good.
But no plan survives first contact with the enemy. And the original Russian plan was that it was all going to be over in 72 hours. The Russian military, you know, had their dress uniforms and instruments with them, ready for a parade when they got into Kiev, as they think they'll just kind of walk in and then be able to kind of march around. And instead they meet fierce Ukrainian resistance, of course, and that plan collapses. But the crucial thing is the signs are that Wagner, this mercenary group, are not part of this original plan. The Kremlin needs to rethink. The 72-hour war is suddenly turning into something very different.
And it's an opportunity for a mercenary.
Yeah. So, you know, finally, you know, on March 19th, nearly a month after the invasion, Prigozhin gets the call.
Who are probably like, we got to call this guy.
Yeah, we got
to.
Yeah.
I hate having to make this call.
Yeah.
You know?
And of course, you know, 175, maybe more, thousand Russian troops for the original invasion plan. Now they realize that's not going to be enough because the Ukrainians are resisting. The Ukrainians have mobilized their population for war. Crucially, the Russians haven't mobilized their entire population and army for war, and they don't want to. Putin is nervous about that because, after all, it's not a war. It's not an invasion. It's a special military operation.
Very special.
Very special.
Yeah.
Which means you do not want to kind of, you know, mobilize everyone and kind of conscript your population. So Prigozhin's going to pull his existing teams from Africa to come and join the fight. Massive influx of new recruits. By June 2022, thought to be 25,000 Wagner fighters in the east of Ukraine. They're going to get tanks, artillery, aerial support from MOD. At its peak, Wagner is going to have 85,000 troops. Now that is, it's worth saying, is bigger than the current serving British army.
Where are they getting all these men, Gordon?
Well, David, where are they getting all these men from? The answer, of course, is somewhere that Evgeny Prigozhin knows incredibly well. Prison. So summer of 2022, Prigozhin personally turns up in Russian penal colonies, often flying in by helicopter, gathers the prisoners in the courtyard to address them. And of course, he knows how to talk to them. He was one of them. You know, this is where our story started.
That's right. It's a heartwarming story.
And he's lived the dream. Now he's a kind of billionaire or multimillionaire businessman flying into the prison colonies, saying to these guys, you know, you could be like me. You could live the dream. You could escape. You can, you know, you can do something. So there's a great video of him, which is maybe secretly filmed, maybe leaked. No one's quite sure. Speaking in Moldova, which comes to light in September 2022, where he gathers hundreds of inmates in a yard and then offers them a deal.
It also seems like, you know, if you're in a Russian penal colony, you might really consider this.
Yeah.
this seems like not a bad deal.
You take the deal.
When you get to the guts of it, it is a pretty frightening thing because you could have a serial rapist.
Yeah.
You could have people who have done some awful things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who go fight and then get
released.
Sent loose back into Russia.
Yeah. So you supposedly get whole units of sex offenders. I mean, you know, which is kind of wild. You get cannibals.
Is there a cannibal unit?
I don't know if there's a cannibal unit, but you get people who
never made it there. They just,
you know,
they ate each other on the way to the front.
And I mean, you know, needs must, you know.
Needs must.
That's Putin's Russia.
That's why Ivan the Cannibal came back home, you know. Never thought we'd see that guy again.
Close to 50,000 prisoners sign up, it's thought. I mean, no one knows for sure. 50,000 prisoners are going to get out this way.
They are given what I would assume would be the worst assignments on the front right?
Yeah.
It has to be, right?
Yeah.
Because they're just so low value
to
the Russian state.
They're completely cannon fodder. You know, they get a week of training. And then, you know, I've been out to Ukraine a couple of times since the war started. And I remember, you know, Ukrainian people on the front line, soldiers who I'd interview, who would talk to me about seeing what they would call meat waves. And I mean, it's a pretty nasty concept, but it was basically that the Russians would just throw waves of people at the Ukrainian lines who were cannon fodder, knowing they would be killed, just to exhaust the Ukrainians, run down their ammo, exhaust them. And then when they felt they were exhausted, then you send in your proper troops who are going to try and break through. So that is what they're using these kind of Wagner conscripts for and what they'll use them for. It's a kind of brutal, intense warfare where you just don't care about human life and you kill anyone who turns around.
Right. And Prigozhin was very clear in that speech.
Yeah.
Deserters would be killed.
Deserters are going to be killed. And there's one particular case that becomes very famous about the kind of punishment. There's a guy called Nevgeny Nuzhin who was a murderer and he was serving a 24-year sentence for murder. So in August, he gets recruited from his prison. He arrives in occupied Luhansk region. It's a little bit vague, but apparently he surrenders to the Ukrainians, gives an interview, in which he talks about this. But then, for some reason, it appears, he gets swapped back to the Russian side in a prisoner swap. Not a good idea. Yeah. Now,
it's the wrong direction to go in.
Wrong direction to go in when you've apparently, you know, surrendered to the Ukrainians. A video appears of this, you know, Evgeny Nuzhin. His head is taped to a concrete block and he confesses to desertion. A man then gets a sledgehammer and smashes his head in, which, as we've seen before, is the kind of the Wagner way of dealing with this. The video goes viral on TikTok. I mean, it gets like millions of views, which is, again, about the kind of dark fan culture around Wagner.
The branding.
And Prigozhin himself says, it seems to me that this film should be called A Dog's Death for a Dog. It was an excellent piece of direction and can be watched in a single sitting. The same month the video comes out, the European Parliament adopts a resolution designating Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism, and it's urging for Wagner to be placed on the kind of terrorist list alongside Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And Prigozhin, or someone, sends a sledgehammer engraved with the Wagner logo and smeared with fake blood in a violin case to the European Parliament. I mean, you know, it's your kind of mafioso horse's head in the bed. Yeah. You know, it's
and it's very theatrical, it's which very I think appeals theatrical. To him, too.
Yeah. The break is there with the West. He's got nothing to lose. He's going to embrace the kind of the dark side. He's going to say, you know, you've heard of Wagner. I cleaned the old weapons myself. I sorted out the bulletproof vest myself. I found specialists who could help with me. From that moment on the 1st of May, 2014. He kind of gives a date. A group of patriots was born, which later came to be called the Wagner Battalion. And yeah, he's also going to admit to being behind the Internet Research Agency. He's kind of not going to try and hide anymore. And I think what he's doing, he's going full in with the Russian nationalist community. A lot of the people around Putin have kind of come through the elite and live in the elite. He has got a bit more of an ordinary background. So he's going to kind of present himself as the voice of the ordinary stroke nationalist patriotic Russian. And he always knew, of course, we've seen how to play the PR game, how to kind of brand himself. And so he's going to go out there and say, I'm the one who is doing what it takes to defend the motherland. I'm an ordinary guy. I'm not one of the elite. I'm not one of those generals or ministers who screwed up this war plan. Because, of course,
it's
everyone Putin, knows screwed up.
Right. Yeah. It's the military.
It's the advisors around him.
The elite in the military.
Screwed up this war. Yeah. You know, they screwed up this invasion plan. And now someone's got to come in and sort it out. And that's going to be me. In Russia, they know things are not going well. So they're looking for anyone who can kind of give them a boost. And there's some early victories for the Wagner forces. And of course, his PR machine, his trolls are kind of starting to boost him and Wagner. And of course, then denigrate the Russian military. This is all going to kind of come to a head over another really significant battle over a place called Bakhmut. From the winter of 2022 becomes probably one of the most brutal, long-running battles of the Ukraine war. Both sides are going to throw everything at this battle, and it becomes an absolutely brutal meat grinder in the mud from late 2022. The Russians are just throwing these kind of meat waves to take sometimes just 100 meters of land a day for very heavy losses. And the Wagner group are being used on the front line, and they're going to be the ones taking the heavy casualties. The US reckon that Wagner have about 30,000 wounded or killed, mainly in Bakhmut. And the stories are just kind of, you know, grim, and people who flee get executed. Some of the kind of maneuverings around here are really interesting and odd. So there's a US intelligence report which gets leaked, something called the Discord leaks, which claims that in January 2023, Prigozhin tries to negotiate with the Ukrainians and through a back channel secretly, and says to the Ukrainians, if they withdraw from Bakhmut and lets him take, and Wagner take Bakhmut, he would give Ukraine information on Russian troop positions so they could attack them. Now, if that's true, it's nuts, isn't it?
But is it in the big if true category?
It is, yeah.
Do you buy it?
I don't know. I mean, it could be that Prigozhin was kind of lying to the you could imagine him telling that to the Ukrainians, just let me take that Bakhmut.
And having no intent
and no intention of following through. But he wants the victory of taking Bakhmut because he knows how much is riding on it. So he might be kind of lying about it rather than really planning to do it. But, you know, he staked his reputation on taking Bakhmut and he promises to take it by May 9th, 2023, you know, victory day in Russia. It's not going well. He's thinking that he's not getting enough ammo from the Russian Ministry of Defense. Now, it may be that they're restricting ammo. It may be that they've not got enough ammo. It may be he's looking for an excuse for why he's not winning. But this is where the whole thing starts to unravel and go out of control. 5th of May, there's a video of Prigozhin standing by corpses of his own men. It looks dark and he sounds kind of angry and wild. And he goes, "These guys are Wagner PMCs that died today. The blood is still fresh. Now listen to me, you bitches. These are someone's fathers, someone's sons." And he's kind of screaming. "And those pieces of shit," sorry about the language, "that don't send ammunition, those bitches will be eating their entrails in hell. We have 70% ammo shortages." And this is the famous line. "Shoigu, Gerasimov, where is the fucking ammunition?"
He's crossing a line here, right?
He's crossing a line here.
Because he hasn't done this.
No.
Up to this point, complaints would have been private or sort of sent through a third party to leak out. And now he's just doing it directly.
And I think it's a sign of desperation. He's not winning as he'd hoped. He's losing men. He's got to blame someone. By this time, maybe 20,000 Wagner men have been killed in the battle alone, killed.
And prior to the war in Ukraine, the entire size of Wagner was like 4,000 to 5,000 people.
Yeah. Right? And then it would grow to 25,000. And now they've just lost, you know, kind of 20,000 in Bakhmut. I mean, they've grown because of the prisoners.
Yeah.
But it's brutal. June 10th, 2023, Shoigu, defense minister, orders all volunteer groups, mercenaries, had to sign official contracts with the Ministry of Defense by the 1st of July. So basically saying, we are going to bring all of these groups under our control. Now, that is basically the end for Wagner. And I think it's also starting to get clearer that Putin is going to have to choose in this increasingly kind of visceral, visible battle between Shoigu and Prigozhin. Putin is going to choose. And the problem for Prigozhin is he's not going to choose him. But this is the moment where Prigozhin realizes he is being locked out. His overall plan of, I'm going to force my way into the inner circle. I'm going to kind of get Putin to kind of get rid of Shoigu. He's overplayed his hand, but what he's going to do is he's going to double down. You know, he's not going to back
down.
As
always.
As always, which is the Prigozhin style. Now, he's going to claim his camp was attacked by the Russians, by missiles, and some of his fighters killed. Now, it looks like that was a kind of staged attack or faked, a kind of pretext. Prigozhin issues a video which is kind of off the rails now because he says the whole justification for the special military operation, the war in Ukraine, is a lie. He says the idea that the people in the Donbass, the east of Ukraine, were suffering genocide at the hands of Ukraine and that Russia had to intervene to protect them from an imminent threat wasn't true. You know, what was the war for, he says? It was needed so that Shoigu could receive a hero star. The oligarchic clan that rules Russia needed the war. Now, this is wild stuff, isn't it? Because he's undermining the whole basis for this war. Challenging on the basis on which it's been sold to the Russian public.
And I guess he's got 25,000 men that in
That's
theory
what he says,
could march.
So he says, the evil carried out by the country's military leadership must be stopped. And so he says he's going to restore justice in the military. And after that, justice for all of Russia. It's a march for justice, David.
Well, I mean, who wouldn't join a march for justice? Yeah. I mean, on Moscow, led by a bunch of ex-convicts.
Yeah. But he's betraying. I love the phrase.
And cannibals marching back to Moscow.
But he's
to
trying
claim
to make it
justice.
Sound like Martin Luther King or something. You know, like we're on a civil rights march. When in fact, it's, as you said, it's prisoners and cannibals and Dmitry Utkin with his SS tattoos, you know.
And then this leads us to Saturday, the 24th of June.
And that is, I can remember this vividly because I was in the BBC that day in the newsroom covering this. And it is one of the more memorable days. it was one of those days where you thought history could turn. You know, this could be the day. And as the day starts and as it unfolds, where you think this could be the day that Putin is removed from power, in which there's a coup in Russia, in which a civil war starts in Russia. As the day was unfolding, you genuinely didn't know what was going to happen or where it was going to end. Because Wagner forces have moved into Russia. They take the military headquarters for the Southern Command of Russia, which is in Rostov-on-Don. Best guess is there's about 8,000 troops, you know, from Wagner who have taken this. Now, the public, it's so interesting. They don't know what to make of it in the city because ordinary life is going on. Wagner troops are now occupying the city and people are asking for selfies with Prigozhin when they see them. They're like, it's Prigozhin. You know, he's the kind of nationalist hero. And he appears in Rostov in a number of videos. And it's a weird scene because the kind of police are there as well. And also some of the regular Russian military.
It would be confusing.
It's just confusing. No one seems to know what to do. And one of the soldiers asks, you know, Prigozhin, what are you doing here? And he says, saving Russia, which is his line. Now, crucially, at 10 o'clock in the morning on the Saturday morning, Putin comes out and he denounces those stabbing Russia in the back at a time of war. This is exactly the kind of blow that was dealt to Russia in 1917 when the country was fighting the First World War, he says, warning about civil war. And he says there's going to be a counterterrorism regime in Moscow. And the organizers of this mutiny have betrayed their own people and their country. And this is, you know, this is a disaster for Prigozhin. Because if the point is negotiation, you know, pressure on Putin to kind of get him to get rid of Shoigu, it's failed.
And let me guess, Gordon, for once in his life, Yevgeny Prigozhin just turns around and backs down,
he
right?
backs down. He goes, yeah, okay, I'll go back. No. Instead,
just keep on going.
He keeps on going because he sends a convoy, a military convoy of Wagner, up the M4 motorway from Rostov to Moscow, to the capital. He must be hoping that on the way, the army, the National Guard maybe will join him. The Russian Air Force flies over and the Wagner team are actually going to shoot down. They've got kind of mobile air defense, at least one, maybe three helicopters and a command aircraft during this. I mean, that's a big deal because you're now... Wagner mercenaries are killing Russian military.
Yeah.
This is the moment where you go civil war. I remember people asking, you know, Putin is bad, but Prigozhin and his nationalist friends, you know, could this actually be worse for Ukraine, for Europe and the world? But the key thing, I guess, is Prigozhin doesn't want to fight. There's some talk that maybe he thinks he's going to take the Ministry of Defense in Moscow and remove Shoigu and, you know, take over. But he's actually on the way. He's still trying to negotiate. This is a negotiating strategy rather than a coup. So he's calling Putin, or he's trying to call Putin, and Putin's not taking his calls. And then crucially, the person who gets involved is Lukashenko, the president of Belarus. And he's got good contacts with both. So he becomes the kind of intermediary. And Lukashenko tells Prigozhin that Putin will not meet with him nor surrender Gerasimov and Shoigu. And Prigozhin supposedly says, but we want justice. They want to strangle us. We will march on Moscow, says Prigozhin. Halfway there, you'll be squashed like a bedbug, Lukashenko replies. So finally, Prigozhin is being told and being warned, don't keep escalating, because if you do, you're going to get squashed.
Do you think Prigozhin was on drugs?
I think that is entirely plausible, isn't it? I mean, it could be, yeah.
This seems like a drug-addled fever dream that he's in the middle
of. No, I think that's entirely plausible.
And then he's going to afterward, you know, he's going to sober up and...
Yeah.
Going to regret some of these things.
So finally, I mean, I guess Lukashenko will talk Prigozhin down after a few of these calls and barter agreement. I think Prigozhin knows he actually at this point
can't win.
So early evening, Prigozhin halts the convoy, effectively gives up. Prigozhin pictured in a black SUV in Rostov, where, as you said, he's been all the time, driven away. And very suddenly.
It's over.
I just remember it so vividly that for hours you thought Putin's going to fall. There's going to be a kind of civil war violence in Moscow. And then suddenly it's literally over. It's amazing. And a deal struck.
And the deal is essentially that Prigozhin will agree to go with any of his men who want to go to Belarus,
yeah.
where they'll be able to set up camp. I guess on the face of it, it's not a bad deal for a mutineer.
No, I mean, I think it's amazingly good deal, isn't it? You're no criminal charges at this point. Immunity. I mean, you've led a mutiny and you're getting immunity for all those involved. You know, I think it's a sign of Putin's weakness at that moment because he just doesn't, you know, Putin's been a bit paralyzed in the day. And I think Putin doesn't want to push things too far and actually have a rebellion, I think the Kremlin knows it's got to deal with him, but it's going to deal with him slowly,
yeah.
you know, and carefully. Because I think Prigozhin has to hand back to the MOD some of his, you know, tanks and artillery, some of his men transfer. I think he knows it's over for him in Ukraine, but he's maybe still hoping he can do the whole Wagner thing around the world because he's still got this base in Belarus. The squeeze is on. He's flying around now, you know, from Belarus to St. Petersburg. It looks like he's just desperate to keep some of his business going around, you know, Concord. He sees his mother that summer, Violetta. When I last saw him, he looked doomed, she will say.
I think Mama Prigozhin might be filtering a lot of these quotes back through what's happened since.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure. I think he probably thought he could keep going, or he hoped he
Certainly,
could.
Certainly, yeah.
But then August 23rd, 2023, 5:46 p.m., executive jet, tail number RA-02795, lifts off from Moscow's airport, heading for St. Petersburg. Now, there had been an inexplicable delay for some repair work, strangely, David, just before the plane takes off, according to one of the crew, cabin stewardess Kristina Raspopova, in a text message to her family. And there are also reports that two potential buyers for the jet had been on board an hour just before it departed. Suspicious, perhaps, some might say in hindsight. But the plane soon reaches its cruising altitude of about 30,000 feet. Just after 6 o'clock, suddenly goes into a steep dive. Eyewitnesses on the ground say they hear two explosions, see the plane falling, disintegrates in the air, losing one wing and part of its tail. No time even for a mayday call. Crashes nearby a village. Flames, smoke rising from the field. Now, this is interesting. All 10 people on the people die, including the pilot, the co-pilot, the stewardess. Obviously, you know, entirely innocent. But the passengers, of course, include Prigozhin himself and Dmitry Utkin, our SS-loving friend, and the head of security and logistics for Wagner, along with two of Wagner soldiers and two of Prigozhin bodyguards. It wipes out, basically, the leadership.
Feels like a mistake to have the entire leadership of Wagner essentially flying together.
Yeah. 2 months to the day since the mutiny. You know, there's some speculation, you know, that a missile took it out. Putin will suggest the crash was caused by Prigozhin and other commanders drinking and using drugs, back to your point,
yeah.
while handling, stroke juggling, grenades on board, which...
This gets back to the... You know, nothing is true and everything is possible.
Yeah, he can say that. Yeah.
Right? It's just, you just make something else that's totally ludicrous.
Yeah.
And then feed that into the state media and there you go. You have to send a message to others who might in the future consider a similar path, right?
Exactly.
That it will be dealt with very directly.
There has to be a price.
And it also says something, I think, about the nature of Putin's payback. And Bill Burns, former CIA director, you know, he's referred to Putin as a great apostle of payback.
Yeah.
And it's so true. And I think the theatrics are important as well, because Prigozhin has been traveling inside Russia in this couple month period. He could have been arrested.
Yeah.
He could have been detained. Other members of his entourage could have been arrested or detained. There wasn't really any need, was there, to kill innocent flight attendants and civilians and to do it in this, you know,
it's performance
big way, right? He could have been quietly murdered.
Yeah.
You know, at one of his properties, he could have been killed in Belarus quite easily, but they chose a very public demonstration of how enemies of Putin and the state are dealt with.
I think that's absolutely right. Putin on his death praises him as a talented person who made mistakes, as if launching a coup or a mutiny was like, you know, a mistake, like a poor post on social media, like, they made the odd mistake.
I agree with Putin's assessment, though, don't you?
Talented person who made mistakes.
Yes,
yeah.
To some degree. I mean, this is definitely the biggest, the most significant elite challenge to Putin since he took power. And he survived it.
The system survived it.
He managed through it. Prigozhin's dead. And Wagner and his empire has sort of been cut up and parceled out.
And Prigozhin is never mentioned again.
And Prigozhin is never mentioned again.